The following program was recorded before the Doctor Who 50th Anniversary Special. Owing to the complete mess-up of the Doctor's timeline presented in Day of the Doctor, please note that during this podcast, our references to the Ninth Doctor refer in fact to the Tenth Doctor, and our references to the Tenth Doctor refer to the Eleventh. Should there be any references to the Eleventh Doctor, they are, of course, in turn references to the Twelfth Doctor. References to Doctors 8 and earlier remain unchanged. We now return you to our regularly scheduled podcast. Take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another special episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And we are going to be looking at the regeneration from the Ninth Doctor to the Tenth Doctor in our review of the Children in Need special.
I've watched The Christmas Invasion, but I guess maybe we could talk about that as a little bonus extra.
Yeah, sort of like a tag. It's kind of extension of the Children in Need, so I suppose we could. Luckily, I happened to watch it at the same time. So, well, let's start off a little summary. The Children in Need special. The Ninth Doctor disappears in an explosion of regenerative energy, and the Tenth Doctor stands in his place. Rose stands back, confused and scared. The Doctor begins to catalog his new body, and he seems to begin to settle in. Then he realizes Rose is scared of him, unsure of what has happened. He finally convinces her, mostly, that he may actually be the Doctor. But when she asks if the old one can come back, he responds no, and he realizes that it may be time for them to part. He sets the coordinates for Earth, Christmas Eve, and then the regeneration begins to go wrong. Doubling over in pain and simultaneously unable to control his exuberance, he cranks the TARDIS up to full speed as the cloister bell warns of impending doom.
Wow, that summary was almost as long as the episode itself.
It was. As would probably the one of the Christmas Invasion, which follows neatly on. Christmas Invasion. Jackie Tyler places a present for Rose under the tree, but she knows her daughter is almost certainly dead after the events of Parting of the Ways. But then she and Mickey, working nearby, hear the sounds of the screaming TARDIS engines, and they run out just in time to see the TARDIS crash into the Powell Estates. Out stumbles a stranger, who greets them by name and wishes them a Merry Christmas before collapsing, unconscious. Not daring to seek medical attention for the Doctor, they take him back to Jackie's, but there is little they can do except wait and let him heal. Mickey takes Rose to shop for a Christmas present for Jackie. It's clear that Rose's mind is on the Doctor, and Mickey expresses his displeasure that the conversation always returns to the Doctor and the TARDIS. Then, mechanical Santa Clauses attack them. Rose realizes that they're after the Doctor for some reason. They return to Jackie's just in time for a mechanical Christmas tree to turn into a spinning buzzsaw of death and attack them and the unconscious Doctor. Rose pleads with the unconscious Doctor to save them, and at the last moment he pops awake and uses the sonic screwdriver to destroy the tree. He darts outside where the Santas are waiting, but with a threatening gesture from the sonic screwdriver, they retreat from the planet. The Doctor tells them that they woke him too soon, and that the Santas were just pilot fish for something meaner and nastier. He collapses again, this time worse than before. One of his hearts even stops. Meanwhile, Harriet Jones, Prime Minister...
I know...
is announcing the triumph of British engineering. The Guinevere space probe is approaching Mars for a Christmas Day landing. Unbeknownst to Mission Control, the probe has been swallowed by a massive alien spacecraft. Later, when the probe is supposed to transmit the first pictures from Mars, instead there is a transmission from the leader of the aliens aboard the ship. The government passes it off as hackers intercepting the signal and making a hoax, but UNIT is activated. Back at Jackie's, Rose and Mickey know that the transmission was real, and that this is a major threat that the Doctor warned of. Rose also notices she cannot understand the aliens. Somehow the TARDIS, because of the Doctor's problem, is not translating for her. The Doctor is truly broken. At UNIT headquarters, They learn to translate the alien language and begin negotiations. The aliens, known as the Sycorax, want the total surrender of Earth. To back up that demand, suddenly one-third of the Earth's population starts moving as if in a trance. They all move towards the tallest buildings that they can find and climb to the top, where they stand on the edge, as if waiting for an order to jump. Harriet Jones, Prime Minister,
I know,
makes a desperate call on TV for the doctor, but the doctor cannot hear it. Later, Harriet Jones, Prime Minister,
I know,
her science advisor, her assistant, and the unit chief are beamed aboard the Sycorax ship to negotiate. Rose decides that the safest place for them is in the TARDIS. They haul the doctor into the TARDIS while Mickey tries to get the screen to work. Instead, he sends a signal. When Jackie returns to her flat for food, the Sycorax detect the TARDIS' signal and beam it aboard along with Rose, Mickey, and the still unconscious doctor. Once outside, Rose tries to bluff the aliens into leaving, but it fails. As the alien leader makes a grandiose speech, Rose suddenly begins to understand him. That can only mean one thing. Everyone turns to see the TARDIS doors open and the doctor step out. He quickly takes control of the situation, releasing the controlled humans on the planet, and finally challenging the Sycorax leader to a duel of honor to determine the fate of Earth. The duel does not go well for the doctor, and he is soon brought to the edge of the ship, hovering high above London. His enemy cuts off the doctor's hand, which falls to the planet below. What luck! It just so happens that within the first 15 hours after a regeneration, a Time Lord can regrow a severed limb instantly, and this new hand is a fighting hand. The doctor now beats the Sycorax leader and forces him to surrender. Victorious, the doctor turns his back on the Sycorax, who tries to kill him from behind. The doctor kills the Sycorax with a Satsuma, which is more properly known as a tangerine. With the Earth saved, and everyone now convinced that he is the doctor, there are joyous celebrations. Harriet Jones, Prime Minister,
I know,
uses Torchwood technology to destroy the fleeing ship. The doctor is outraged and arranges for her government to fall. After Christmas dinner and a new set of clothes, the doctor prepares to leave, and Rose is once again given the chance of staying at home or going with the doctor. She chooses to go. End of story. So, regeneration episode, episodes, as a whole, what do you think?
Well, I think it's excellent, actually. I think that it's a proper regeneration episode, which is not something we've had for a couple of these now, because obviously with Rose, we were seeing the relaunch, and similarly with Grace 1999, although it didn't lead to a series, it was an attempt to kind of create something new. So there was a much sort of greater emphasis on a new beginning, whereas what we got with this was much more of a continuation of the series, building on what had gone before, and a lot of the things that were about reassuring viewers that what we were seeing was very much the same Doctor and was very much the same show. So in some respects, it had a lot in common with the kind of regeneration stories that we've seen before, like Power of the Daleks introducing the Second Doctor, Castrovalva introducing the Fifth Doctor, where the focus was very much on bringing the viewers along. So from that point of view, I thought it was an interesting episode, and I thought in terms of achieving that, it did it pretty much textbook. And it was a solidly entertaining episode as well. So all round, I mean, Christmas Invasion more than the Children in Need special, which I think was something of a kind of trailer, really, a little kind of bumper for the Christmas Invasion. But yeah, I enjoyed it.
I did enjoy the story, so I don't want to make it sound like I'm poo-pooing it right off the bat. And in particular, when David Tennant stepped out of the TARDIS on the Sycorax ship, he owned the Doctor within 30 seconds. I mean, he completely and absolutely got a cheer from me, because within just, you know, a little bit of babbling, it was clear the Doctor was back. And that's no slight on Christopher Eccleston, but all throughout the Christopher Eccleston era, I was willing to accept him as the Doctor, because this is Doctor Who. The show is different. the ideas behind it are a little bit different. You know, we're a little bit more companion-centric. It's a little bit, you know, it may be edgier. It's meant to be a different show. And so I was accepting the difference in the way the Doctor was played, not just as a different regeneration of all the previous Doctors, but kind of, you know, well, this is the way Doctor Who kind of is now. But David Tennant nailed it back to classic Doctor Who for me immediately. It's just like, wow, we actually now have the 10th Doctor as opposed to maybe the other one was the first Doctor in a new series.
Yes. I couldn't have put that any better. And I think it owes in part the structure of the episode builds to that, because it in the same way that we saw happen in Spearhead from Space, the Doctor is taken out of action for a period so that you're left wondering, is he, it's actually explicitly asked by Rose, is he still the Doctor? Is he really going to be able to do what the hero of the previous series, I mean, imagining yourself as a new viewer, what the hero of the previous series did, and for us as kind of long-term viewers, where will he be able to do what the Doctor, the real Doctor, should be able to do, which is, you know, step out and defeat the aliens and save the Earth and save the day. And so structuring the episode so that you get that at the kind of climax of the story is, I think, a really clever, neat touch. But I also think Tennant is just superb. And watching this, I vacillate a bit between who my favourite Doctors are, between Trout and Tennant and Smith. And this just reminds me that Tennant really is up there. And not only that, like you say, he manages to kind of encapsulate it. It's almost like in that performance, which is a very kind of transparent, very emotive performance, but he manages to bring into it, and I think this is the kind of uber fan that we know him to be, the imperious old man, the clowns there, the action hero, the unpredictable alien, the earnest do-gooder, the bombastic show-off, the schemer, the romantic. There's a little bit of all of them in there, in his performance as the 10th Doctor, and quite a lot of that is there already in just that kind of... It's really just a few scenes at the end of this episode where we get mm-hmm. him kind of performing it, but he absolutely nails it, and he does it in what had to be the first episode. I mean, they have to be the first episode scenes that he filmed as the Doctor because of the sequence where it came as the Christmas special, rather than an episode in a series where you could juggle it around and give him a couple of episodes to kind of get into the role before you actually film what is going to be the debut episode.
I suppose that I can see some of those other characters in there, but I honestly, and this is not to say it's a copy in any way, shape, or form, but Tom Baker could have strolled out of that TARDIS and gave that performance.
It's very Tom Baker.
It's very, very Tom Baker. And that's, I think, really what cinches it back for me. It says, no, this is the 10th Doctor, not the second new Doctor. And not that, you know, one Doctor has to be derivative of another, but I can see 4 in 10. And, you know, just as we can see 2 in 11. And some of the others too, but it's
I see 5 in 11 as well, but
it's a much more Doctor Who caricature-y performance, whereas Eccleston's was toned down. You know, it was sort of more, well, if he were an alien, he perhaps wouldn't be wearing a 14-foot scarf and flamboyantly running around. You know, maybe he would just be kind of a guy who's really kind of clever and occasionally looks, you know, does things strangely, but or has a different point of view. And that's what I get out of Eccleston. And then when we move into Tennant, it's like, now that's the alien Time Lord we knew before. So I'm not trying to pick on Eccleston, because I think it was deliberate, and I think it was probably a good choice. Although I don't know, you know, maybe Tennant's performance, he could have been the 9th Doctor, and I think he still would have owned it. So
I think he would have been fantastic, and I wanted him to be the 9th Doctor. I was a fan of Eccleston before he became the Doctor, so he was a terrific actor. But the roles that he plays are so down to earth. I mean, he has a kind of, there's a real presence there, a real kind of threatening humanity, I suppose, to him. And I think Tennant's Doctor is very human as well, but there's something very down to earth about the roles that Eccleston has played, whereas there's, and also, I think I mentioned this when we were talking about Rose, but I didn't quite think he ever got comedy timing.
No.
It just wasn't something that he seemed to be, it didn't seem to be part of his repertoire. So he could do the kind of playing the idiot a bit.
But the humor in the writing of the Ninth Doctor series was very sophomoric too. I mean, it was, not saying that Doctor Who humor isn't in general sophomoric, but it's, you know, it's fart jokes and things like that. And it's a different, it's not really written funny per se, not what I consider funny. And so when they were the little bits that were supposed to be funny, yeah, he couldn't do it. Tennant
can get a laugh out of a line there isn't a joke in. I mean, he's just
the way he modulates his voice up and down.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, his delivery is just amazing. And he does have this very kind of, anything he's portraying just registers. It's totally there. It's like every single line, he has totally understood what the line means to him and has completely conveyed that to you as the audience. I think it's all round, and it's an extraordinary performance. He's an extraordinary performer. And as a Doctor Who fan, there's another dimension to that, which is that you do see, I absolutely agree, there's a lot of Tom Baker, particularly in these scenes. But, you know, perhaps just a little bit of you know, the no second chances. There's a bit of maybe the First Doctor, maybe the Seventh Doctor in there. I just see these things, and maybe I read them in, but I know what a nerd he is, so right. I can't believe that he isn't thinking of them.
And I this is why I so look forward to Peter Capaldi, just because I know what a nerd he is. So he could be, you know, phenomenal. But I guess we'll get to that when we get to his. We won't really be able to do his regeneration episode until he's done, right? Because our idea is to compare it to comes
absolutely.
Later.
Yeah. So, we can come back to it, but hopefully not before, I don't know, 2020 at the earliest.
Yeah, that seems right. Yeah, at least, yeah.
But, speaking of regeneration, I mean, I did want Tennant to be the Ninth Doctor, or the Doctor who came back on screen. But looking back, what this episode has to do is it has to sell regeneration as a concept to an audience of a show that is just... It's still finding its way.
1 year old, yeah.
And it hasn't really proved itself at this point. I mean, we know how phenomenally successful the revived show 21st Century Who has become. But at the time, certainly when Eccleston was going, they couldn't have had a clue how the show would be received. And so in a way, it all seems quite risky. But looking back with the benefit of hindsight, I think it's worked out quite well, because had you had Tennant in that role Tennant wouldn't have left after a year. We know he's keen on the job beyond it just being a job because of his connection with the show. And so he would have certainly done the kind of three series, maybe more, that he did if he'd stuck around. But then you'd have had an audience who completely identified the character, that central role of the Doctor with Tennant, because he'd obviously been so fantastic, and even as the second actor to play it, he really pretty much did make it his. So in a way, I think we've got the fact that Eccleston went after only one series, and the fact that Tennant was just so fabulously strong, to thank for the fact that it's easier now for a new actor to step in the role and for people to accept it.
This is kind of like the situation. If we could look back at Doctor Who and try to imagine if Tom Baker had been the first Doctor and run 7 years.
And the show would have died.
Probably, yeah. I think a lot of people like Peter Davison. I don't dislike Peter Davison in any way, shape, or form. But I certainly did not like his Doctor as much as I did the fourth. And I don't even know that they would have gone that route.
They wouldn't have gone for something so different.
No.
Because they wouldn't have dared to do that. It's because of the template that had been set by the earlier changes.
But they did from Hartnell to Troughton.
Well, I don't know. I mean, was it so very different? I think it's a brave thing because it had never been done before, and they didn't play it as a new actor who's just changed his appearance. They played it as a change of character, which is an extraordinary thing to do. You know, if you imagine a world of television where that had never been done before, I mean, now that is how we see Doctor Who. But of course, that was completely new.
Well, we do know that their first thought for changing William Hartnell was to make him, and he is, although the episode doesn't exist, invisible throughout the Celestial Toymaker, and at the end of the episode, come back looking like a different person. Because something to do with the invisible. That was the original plan for replacing William Hartnell. And it was just changes in production crew that caused that not to happen.
How funny. It's like in The Mind Robber where Jamie's face changes for an episode.
Oh, that was brilliant. That would have been a perfect time to change Jamie. I mean, But they
used it just because, I don't know, he had flu or something when they were filming it, didn't he? And, you know, again, it's another of these kind of production problems that gets converted into a fabulous story idea that, you know, Doctor Who just seems to have been able to get away with these things. And that's what's made the show last for 50 years.
So let me ask you this, because, of course, I live in a different country and a different group of people have Doctor Who in their psyche. You know, I think even non-nerds who grew up, even at your age, knew who Doctor Who was, even though it was dying its swan song in the classic era. So a lot of people say, you know, now new Doctor Who had to come back and introduce it to a completely and utterly new audience who know nothing about any of this stuff. But is that really true?
Yes.
I mean, I don't read Superman comic books, but I know he's allergic to kryptonite. And so, you know, just because I don't, somebody who lives in Britain or doesn't know who Doctor Who is, isn't that kind of that level of mythos in the culture? I mean, there are, you know, there are tropes that people, because I still, you know, all through the period where Doctor Who was on, you still hear comedians make jokes about TARDIS's dogs being like TARDISes with more shit inside of them than could possibly in them, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
but you're playing to more and more of a niche audience. I mean, I think when the show came back in 2005 and it hadn't been around for 16 years, you've got to bear in mind, when I was growing up, I mean, you can say the show was maybe dying away a bit, but from such a, it had been a phenomenon. And so I remember with Davison as the Doctor, people playing Daleks in the playground and all this kind of thing. There were, I mean, you've got to imagine kids who were 16 years old. Doctor Who had never been, I mean, apart from the 96 movie, Doctor Who had never been on the television in their lifetime. And all of their...
But they knew the name, right?
I don't think you can be sure of that, no. Because I think this thing...
They
fades.
Know what a Dalek was?
I don't think so, no.
Interesting.
I don't think so. I mean, I obviously didn't conduct surveys or anything on it.
Well, you should have.
But, you know... So, I mean, some of these kids I was teaching and the things they didn't know about that I thought everyone must know about, they just continued to surprise me, but they were a different generation, you know. They'd never heard of Blackadder, but they thought nothing of it. It was that kind of thing.
I never heard of Blackadder.
Exactly.
No, that's not even possible. All right. So turning back to the episode then a little bit, one of the things I don't care for about The Christmas Invasion is, yes, we build up to a very triumphant win for the Doctor there, an appearance of the Doctor at the ending, but I think they spent too much time putzing along with Rose and the family in this episode.
I quite like, I mean, this is the first story we've had a full hour for. All the other ones at 45 minutes. The pacing never felt quite right to me, except perhaps a couple of the two-parters. I like the fact there was some padding in this. I mean, you got the old unit back, and you know, like you say, you've got a Doctor who feels like a Doctor who connects us back to the 20th century series. I think having padding in it is part of Doctor Who as well.
But a lot of that is you know, you get to that end. He so triumphantly takes that episode in that last 10, 15 minutes that the rest of it's forgotten to me. It's like, yeah. Wow, I would forgive everything that went on before up to that point, because when they got to this, it was the Doctor is back. Yay. It's Christmas, whatever it happens to be. But kind of, and I watch Doctor Who, and I repeatedly watch Doctor Who. I don't tend to watch Christmas specials more than once. And I actually don't believe I've watched this one since it aired, because it's Christmas. And, you know, even the day after Christmas, I just don't want to watch another Christmassy thing. And
This was the first Christmas special, I suppose.
There's the Feast of Stephen.
Okay, yeah, I haven't watched that.
Well, no. Very, very few people have in the last 50 years, but
obviously, it's famous for breaking the fourth wall and so forth.
Apparently, but that wasn't intentional.
It was part of a regular run of the show as well. Whereas this is Doctor Who as an event on Christmas Day. So it's another new thing that at the time the show was breaking ground.
Yeah, and I'm so a couple of things. The Santa Claus pilot fish, the spinning Christmas tree, as a Christmas special, I'm sure one of the other podcasts, and I was with you or Ben or David or something, we talked about Christmas specials and how in the U.S. anyway, they have a ability to take a show that might be completely grounded in the real world. And when it comes to the Christmas episode, an angel comes down and visits someone, or ghosts are real for that one kind of Christmas carol-y kind of thing. And so they... It's not breaking the fourth wall, but it's breaking the reality of the series as it stands. And then afterwards, it's forgotten. And the series goes back to being six 20-somethings living in an apartment building in New York, or whatever it happens to be. And that's one of the reasons I don't really care for Christmas specials, because you can't really treat them as part of the universe that show belongs to. You just kind of... And I get a little of that in this one. I just do not buy that the pilot fish would send down robots that look like Santa Claus, or that they would choose to deliver a special Christmas tree to the house so that it could whirl up and destroy them, when all they had to do was to, well, A, they didn't even have to deliver the Christmas tree. They could have just put it outside. It could have gone through the door, cut its way in. I mean, you didn't have to sneak that Christmas tree in. But at the same time, you know, why did it have to look like a Christmas tree? What did they accomplish there? And so, therefore, I see the trappings of, oh, let's make it festive. This is a holiday special. And that doesn't sit quite right with me. And it's hard for me to take it in continuity. But because it's a regeneration episode, we have no choice.
But okay. I mean, I think it might have been when we were talking about the Christmas Carol.
One of the earlier ones, yeah.
That we had this discussion before, because there are certain things in that where I could perhaps accept that certain rules, if rules really do exist in Doctor Who, were being broken. But I'm not sure that's a fair criticism here. I mean, I may be viewing it differently, because we don't really have that I think the only British series where I've seen that happen was an episode of The Bill, and The Bill is normally a very kind of, used to be at least, a very kind of straight, relatively sort of supposedly gritty police drama, and they had this beautiful Christmas special with this fantasy element in it. It was extraordinarily well done, but that was so surprising to me, because I'd never seen anything like that. So I just take the Christmas special stuff to be as it comes. Now with Doctor Who, I kind of think you're talking about certain contrivances, certain plot conveniences that happen in any Doctor Who episode. And yeah, I would agree, the Christmas tree, it's a pretty daft way of getting the Christmas tree in there to threaten them. But I think the Santas are more successful, and there is almost a kind of sense to it because they're wearing disguises so as to fit in until they identify Rose, and then they go after her. And I mean, it's the kind of thing that we've seen. I mean, it's actually something that Moffat does quite a lot, which is the taking of something familiar, like the masked men in the girl in the fireplace, or just making cracks in the bedroom scary or whatever. There's something slightly sinister already about Father Christmas. So to take Father Christmases and turn them into, you know, trombone gun wielding aliens is quite a good way of making something commonplace scary. And you can criticize it, but it happens in other episodes as well, not just in this one. So it's not clear to me it's because it's a Christmas special that there are any additional liberties being taken.
The tree more so than Father Christmas will.
The tree,
I'll
give you, it doesn't work that well.
And then,
but I, you know, it's not the only episode where they stick something in where you think that doesn't make much sense, or that's a stupid alien to have done it that way.
And then there is the fact that they're there at all. The pilot fish subplot.
It's the padding, yeah.
Doesn't add anything.
But
so that whole subplot has actually been added to get the Christmas element into this story, because none of the Sycorax or anything like that. That's just plain.
I think it's more
Doctor
than
Who.
That. I think the structure of the story does need a subplot, because you need for something to be going on while the Doctor's lying around in bed, so that you don't when he does leap out and save the day in the end, it's all the more dramatic. So I think there's more of a need for it than it simply being let's add something festive into this one.
So let's talk about the Rose and her breakup trauma with the Ninth Doctor there. To me, throughout most of this episode, it feels like she and you know, this is totally inconsistent, not inconsistent, with the RTD ethos of the companion really being kind of the star and the Doctor just sort of being the guide, if you will, whether that's travel guide, ethical guide, spiritual guide, whatever it happens to be. But that, you know, the companion is really kind of the star here. And we have seen that this sort of parallels a love affair, if it isn't a love affair, with her and the Doctor. And in this, it feels like they're intentionally making this, the Doctor left me and dumped me. And because she cries that, she says that more or less, he left me, Mom, or Mickey, or whoever she was crying on at that moment. you know, the wall, whatever she was whining on, I don't remember. And it all the way feels like that throughout pretty much most of the episode. Even though she's at times doting on Tennant and trying to help him and whatnot, but there is still that, you know, he left me.
I agree.
Watching it again, I don't think that's right. It is what she's doing, but I feel like she should be mourning him, not feeling like he betrayed her, because that's what I get out of it. I mean, I know sometimes when people die, a distressed partner does occasionally take on an attitude like it was a betrayal of them getting hit by a car or whatever it happens to be. But usually,
yeah, I mean,
it's more grief.
It is one of the stages of grief, isn't it? And I think this works really, really well. I think it's one of the huge strengths of it. I don't think it's entirely new. I think you're right. What is going on there is a kind of, there's a slightly modern take on it, which is to take the kind of love aspect of this relationship that's being going on there, because the person who she thinks she had developed this relationship with appears to have disappeared. And so there's the grief over that. And when this kind of fabulous new Doctor emerges at the end, when Tennant swaggers in his pyjamas and saves the day, then, you know, Ninth Doctor, what Ninth Doctor? She's completely over him because this, you know, wonderful new interest has appeared, who happens to be the same person, it's true.
So, but we but never... I, Go ahead.
I don't think that's new. I think that's a modern way of portraying it. The thing of the companion being the important person, that, you know, that's there in the very early Who. And when we see the first Doctor become the second Doctor, it's the reactions of Ben and Polly that are important to us, that help us to understand what's going on, because they express for us the surprise, they express the shock at the disappearance of the companion they knew and the appearance of this stranger in his place, and the disbelief at it and the fact that he could not be the same person. They're expressing that for us. And that's what's going on when all of the kind of additional companions are added for Baker to be regenerated into Davison or whatever. It's those reactions that matter, because they are expressing our feelings. So yeah, you can see that as being the modern way of telling it through a kind of relationship breakup of, oh, he dumped me. But that's what we're feeling as the audience. You know, Eccleston has left the show. Eccleston was playing the starring role and he has dumped us, the audience. What are we supposed to do? Are we going to stick with this show now? He's just swanned off. And then,
yeah, was that a dig at Eccleston, actually, now that you mention it?
I don't think so. I don't think
it never occurred to me till you said that. But I mean, yeah, he did dump us. I mean, that's the one thing I complain at Eccleston, is that he basically stuck a finger up at the fans and said, yeah, I hate this. I'm out of here.
Well, you know, no, it's a job. He did what he was contracted to do. I think we've had this argument before. But I also don't think they're digging at Eccleston here. I think what they are trying to do, what Russell T. Davies is trying to do, is exactly what showrunners have done in the past, and that is to give expression to what he anticipates will be the kind of feeling of the mass of the audience as to the loss of the actor who was playing the lead role, who was carrying the show.
I wonder if, I mean, again, taking the show back to the point where, let's say, the audience doesn't understand the concept of regeneration. You know, as a human being, you could argue that no one is equipped for a death or a breakup emotionally, but we all have that sort of basic understanding of those things. No human being is equipped for a regeneration of a character. That is something beyond the human experience. And so each writer, I think, has taken it and tried to apply some human reaction to it. In this case, a breakup from a boyfriend. But I don't know that it rings true with me. I mean, I see it. I see what she's doing, and I can't quite empathize with it. And whether that's because I know about regenerations, or whether that I don't love Christopher Eccleston, or whatever
you don't know the case. I mean, what you know about regenerations is, you know, what happens on screen in Doctor Who. If someone close to you, if someone you loved regenerated, I think you would probably feel you didn't really know about it.
But I don't know that I would.
For a start, you'd be quite surprised.
You'd be quite surprised. I just don't know that I would treat that as, you know, if my wife regenerated today, I don't know that I would. Particularly if I saw that she was dying from radiation poisoning and then suddenly she said, I'm going to change to another person. I don't know that if I would feel like she ran out on me. I just don't quite get. I would be confused. I would be possibly scared senseless of it. All sorts of things. But I just don't know that I would.
I think everyone reacts differently and different situations too. I think it's one of those things where you can't. But you can't expect everyone to react in the same way. So,
but one of the things that Russell T. Davies is lauded for in his scripts is the ability to convey that emotions in scripts convincingly,
yes,
to people, and that means that he can reach out and accurately assess his audience and put the finger on it. And in this case, he didn't. Now he's very good at it. I agree, but he didn't do it for me. That's right.
But no. I don't think he ever would be able to write something that for every person watching you get that emotional reaction, that emotional understanding to what's going on with it. To me, it is a perfectly understandable and interesting reaction to take. And to a degree, although, you know, like you, I wasn't so keen on Eccleston in the role and very, very keen on Tennant in the role. So I wasn't feeling particularly dumped. But to me, that does kind of, I'm feeling a bit dumped by Matt Smith at the moment. So I kind of understand that dynamic.
I just kind of feel like for a writer of his caliber that I'm just expecting something a little more clever. It feels a little slightly cliche.
But I don't think he's a clever writer in the way that Moffat is a clever writer. Moffat does clever things that impress you with the fact that he's, you know, thought his way through the fourth dimension. Whereas Davies, I think, is more focused on writing truer things. Funny things, maybe, sad things, maybe, but he's more interested in getting to the truth of them than trying to do something twisted or unusual. I think.
Okay, let's cut here just a second so I let the dog out, because I think maybe he's trying to tell me he needs to go to the bathroom or something, because he's starting to whine. All right, dog. Yes, please! Let me out! But she eagerly and excitedly runs out the back door and comes around to the screen door and is just sitting there staring at me.
I think he was just trying to say he likes Russell T. Davies.
Maybe that's it. All right, let's pick it up here. I'll move on to a different topic. In 5, 4, 3. So now, let's talk a little bit about Children in Need and the Christmas Invasion together. We do see the regeneration at the end of Parting of the Ways. And I think we get as far as, oh yes, Barcelona. Right?
Right.
That's where we get to. So he regenerates. Does he do the mole bit? I don't remember if he got as far as, I don't remember the order of that. But, you know, he doesn't. So he kind of has the hair, the teeth, ooh, new teeth. Where were we, Barcelona? And then we end the episode. And if you didn't have Children in Need, the next thing we would see is the TARDIS smashing into the Powell Estates, basically, and this new guy stumbling out and collapsing in Jackie and Mickey's arms. I feel like Children in Need, well, it's two things to it. I mean, we know, you and I and longtime fans know that the Doctor doesn't usually regenerate very smoothly. And
indeed.
So
one of the things that we've seen in loads and loads of these regenerations we've discussed is trauma.
And so there's no sign of that trauma really at the end of Parting of the Ways. He's you know, Barcelona. And then the end, he's not plopping all, because very few doctors have ever, Colin Baker possibly is the exception. And he's up for a while before he starts collapsing. So maybe there's a... But we really don't see that transition from up and healthy to suddenly I'm falling all over myself. And I just kind of feel like something's missing if you don't have Children in Need in there. And so my question is, should Children of Need been added to the beginning of the Christmas Invasion? I mean, sure, okay, fine, show it as a special and try to get some money and whatnot. But should they have redone it? I was disappointed when they didn't redo it. I mean, my first thought was... they've removed his regeneration scene from this episode where it should have been, and now it won't be on the DVD, even when it was airing Christmas Day. I'm like, they cut the regeneration scene out. They cut the important part out of this.
I think
we get our first few lines of him and the companion doing their initial sort of who the heck are you, who am I kind of thing, and it's gone. It's just not there.
I guess... I was surprised at first that they didn't show the recap at the beginning of the Christmas Invasion. So you didn't see the Ninth Doctor. Because I think if you were viewing just the Christmas Invasion on its own, you would not necessarily understand what Rose was talking about. And
there's that too. They didn't show the recap of the Ninth Doctor.
Knowing that there had been a man with a different face. The Children in Need special is too long. It's too much padding and nonsense. I mean, I think some of it is quite useful, because like I say, the reaction of the companion is kind of the important thing. But the actual the regeneration has gone wrong. You'd have to be an idiot not to realise that from watching The Christmas Invasion. So it's not like you can't work out what has happened. And I'm not a big fan of saying, well, if you can work it out, you don't have to spell everything out on screen.
But actually, if that was your first episode of Doctor Who ever, you wouldn't know there would have been a regeneration or even what Rose had seen. Because they did cut out the Ninth Doctor bursting into... I mean, that's been...
That's the bit. That's the fact that you didn't see the Ninth Doctor change into the Tenth Doctor, so you didn't actually see that he really was a different man. That concept is going to take a while. You know, people saying he's not the same person, you're going to think, well, what's going on there? You know, your immediate thought is not going to be, actually, he is the same person. He's just completely changed his appearance, unless you know something about Doctor Who.
This is the danger of any show that ends a season with a cliffhanger, which is what that basically is.
Yeah.
Is that if you end it with a cliffhanger, anyone new coming into your audience is got to be brought up to speed somehow. And the time-honored tradition has been to show...
Yeah, previously Doctor Who.
And the part leading right up to that cliffhanger, so that you know what the cliffhanger was. And here you don't get it. Now, I would agree with you. I think the scene goes on too long. The Children in Need special goes on too long. And because the tone of that, where he's really not having problems, most of it anyway, and into the other, it does feel like it's a scene that probably needed a lot of trimming. But I particularly think that the scene where he takes Rose's hand, you know, she's afraid of him. She thinks an alien has teleported into his body. I mean, who knows? Again, this falls into that category. I said, we don't know what would happen if someone who was close to us just regenerated like that. I mean, in the Doctor Who universe, you'd go, well, I did happen to know that they were a freaking amazing alien. And so, okay, weird things do happen. It wouldn't be quite like if you were just walking down the street and one of your colleagues did it or something. But you have been traveling through time and space, Rose. You have seen a bunch of strange things. So, you know, we're going to give you a little grounds here to say you should at least be able to take a little of it in the stride. But he said it was going to happen, even though it wasn't terribly clear. You saw it happen right in front of your eyes. You're unsure. I'm good. She plays that very, very well. What happened? Did an alien take over? But the scene where the Doctor takes her hand and talks to her about the Autons and the first time we ever saw each other, and that scene is the best companion handover from one Doctor to the other that we've ever had, because he does it. He puts in her mind, you know, 51%, this is probably the Doctor.
Yeah.
Whereas they didn't have that, like, in Power of the Daleks. That was, you know, they were going through that whole thing about, you know, this, that, the other. Oh, I don't remember. Different person, different mind. Ring doesn't fit. It was really about why it couldn't be the same guy. And here is the scene really convincing you, not just because you saw it in front of your own eyes, but because now I am going to convince you that I am. And that's brilliant. And also the scene where she kind of says, you know, can you change back? And he says, do you want me to? And she goes, yeah. Oh, sorry. those two pieces are, to me, are so important that it's unconscionable that they took that out of the proper regeneration episode.
Okay. Well, I love it. I think you're right. Those moments within that are really nice. But I think they're having their cake and eating it, really. One of the reasons that you get this is because you have this little sequence in the TARDIS where the Doctor has actually regenerated without all of the usual trauma. I mean, he's basically just stood up, done the regeneration thing, and boom, now he's straight on to checking whether he's ginger and, you know, liking his teeth. So that's quite unusual, and that's why we haven't really had that kind of opportunity for the companion, who is the one being scared, to be reassured by the Doctor, who is the one who's calm and collected. But they're having their cake and eating it, because in The Christmas Invasion,
they've undone it.
Well, the important thing is, because it's a regeneration story and because it has so many things in common with all of these other regeneration stories that we've been watching and some of which we've actually enjoyed, it has to have that thing of there being a regeneration trauma, and therefore the doctor to be all over the place and the companion to be the one who's holding it together. And that's what matters for the Christmas Invasion, and it would work just fine if they didn't have the children in need bit at all. It could go straight from the end of the Parting of the Ways into the Christmas Invasion, and that would work. But because they have this opportunity to show a little scene that stands on its own, separate from it, they do get to write this really nice sequence where you do have the Doctor giving the reassurance and trying to persuade Rose. But the one thing I would disagree with you on there is he doesn't actually convince her. Because if he did, he would spoil the Christmas Invasion.
Well, that's what I mean. I think he gets about 51% of the way of convincing. I mean, she was totally... I don't think she believes it until he takes her hand, talks to her about Run. And I think that she's quite a long ways towards being convinced.
That's
completely all undone by the time they get into the Christmas Invasion. I saw it happen, but...
I don't think she's convinced by it. I think she starts to entertain the possibility that he might be the same person on an intellectual level, but she doesn't really feel that it's true, so it doesn't actually convince her. What convinces her is seeing the Doctor in action against the Sycorax on the Sycorax spaceship, and it's because of what he shows her rather than what he says. So, and I think it has to be like that because... For us, the audience, we have to be convinced as well. So you have to go through the trauma and you have to have this thing where the Doctor emerges from it and is triumphant. We go, yay, Tennant, and everything's good.
But, well, so you mentioned we always have the trauma, but that's not strictly true. I know it's easy to put out of your mind, but Twin Dilemma, the Doctor is up and bounding around and, you know, seemingly
and
healthy and well.
Strangling his companion.
But that happens about the same length of time after the regeneration as the Doctor suddenly going, oh, I haven't touched that switch in a long time, and starts cranking up the TARDIS. So he had about a minute of lucid, I'm up and going, and then the problems start occurring. So, I mean, it does have a parallel, whereas if you took a look at...
The Twin Dilemma is terrible.
And
one,
terrible.
One of the reasons for that is because the trauma in that doesn't
It's the way
work.
The trauma is portrayed, right?
Yeah, and it is this kind of slightly on-off thing about it.
But I
not,
could have seen
the
him...
Doctor out like you do in Spearhead from Space or the Christmas Invasion. That works because,
yep.
You know, we understand what, you know, being incapacitated or in a coma is about. But we don't understand when the Doctor has transformed and is one moment being a kind of obnoxious and bombastic idiot and the next minute is being kind of, oh, what came over me? We don't understand what's going on because we don't know who the real Doctor is, and we're being shown something and told maybe this isn't the real Doctor, but you know, how we don't have the tools to know. We can't see that from what we're being shown.
Well, it's just that the pattern has been there of regeneration episodes. The brief lucidity at the beginning of Children in Need is not unprecedented. It may be poorly precedented, as in the case of the Twin Dilemma, but it's not.
It works.
You know, they've done it. You know, the Spearhead from Space, the Doctor basically is unconscious, and throughout most of the episode, he's unconscious. In Robot, I think they really kind of imply exactly the same thing, except that, a lot of the time where he's unconscious is not shown.
Yeah.
Sarah Jane has enough time to go home and change her clothes. And you know, I don't know. How long do you think the Doctor was unconscious in Spearhead from Space? To me, it feels like we're talking days. And in this one, it feels like days. It really feels like days. And then we find out it's been less than 15 hours.
Oh, I'm not sure.
It is Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, but it just seems so long to me.
It seems like hours in both of them to me. I might have to go back to Spearhead from Space to check that, but it seems like hours. Maybe it's even harder to tell with Castrovel because they're in the TARDIS. But maybe
that seems
more
like hours.
Than a day. But each time, yeah, to me it feels like hours really.
Hmm. I kind of got the feeling that Pertwee's and Baker's were quite a bit longer. They were unconscious for...
Well, I mean, it's hours for Sarah Jane to go home.
Well, we don't know that she... Well, I assume she came back the next day. Although, I question whether or not she would be, you know, come back from traveling in the TARDIS. Well, she didn't come back from traveling in the TARDIS. All right, never mind. I'll take that back. The doctor had been traveling in a TARDIS for a while, so... Anyhow, it was just... I don't know. I feel like they missed a trick there that should be in the Christmas Invasion and not this, frankly, children in need, I gather, is a big thing. But, of course, no one else in the rest of the world has any clue. And so when you're making a program which, for example, nowadays is being transmitted simultaneously here in every world, you couldn't do it. I don't think they could or should do it. I feel like it should be in Christmas Invasion, at least parts of it.
It's got a couple of nice scenes in it, like you say, but I think it works. The Christmas Invasion works without it. And that's the key thing, really. You could bolt it on. It's there on the DVDs. It's there as an extra. So, you know, you get it, but the Christmas Invasion,
but it's not available on Netflix.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
But, which is, a lot of people get their stuff off Netflix now, I have to say.
It's a shame they can't see it. I don't think that the Christmas Invasion is impaired by it not being there. I think the Christmas Invasion makes perfect sense without it.
Anyway, I think that's it. I don't know that I have anything else on this particular regeneration other than, I suppose we haven't, you know, is he playing the fully formed Doctor when he comes out at the end?
I think he is. I think the tenth Doctor almost has a story arc because there is this kind of after you've had the ninth Doctor being very kind of somber and scarred from the Time War and all the rest of it, you then have this slightly happy-go-lucky character who's always off to a new planet to explore with Rose, and isn't that wonderful? I'm reminded of, I think it's in the Impossible Planet where they land it. They land in the wrong place in that, don't they?
Which one?
The Impossible Planet.
Don't remember if they landed. Well, they obviously landed somewhere they weren't expecting, but I don't know that they were aiming for anything.
Because they say, shall we go back in the TARDIS and go to where it was we were intending to go? And then burst about laughing because that's just not what they do. There is that real sense there of there being a kind of happy-go-lucky, oh, we've ended up here, well, let's go and have an explore. And then, obviously, you get the parting with Rose, and the Doctor becomes very maudlin about this. You also get the Doctor, you get a little bit of this, you know, the no second chances kind of guy, but the universe's policeman, particularly in school reunion, where he kind of says, you know, in Time Lord's absence, then he's just going to make sure that everyone obeys the laws. And that kind of sense of him being the one who sets the rules builds up to that point in The Waters of Mars where it all comes together and you think, wow, this is a fantastic arc that they've drawn together. It's going to lead into this amazing finale for him. And then, of course, sadly, it doesn't. But I think all of those aspects of the 10th Doctor do feel almost like a story arc, and you just get little glimpses of them. Perhaps not the maudlin Doctor, but certainly the kind of the swaggering, daring, cheery Doctor you get, but also the no second chances and the don't you think she looks tired kind of scheming Doctor in this. So and you know, it's all there. It's all there in his first performance. I think it's amazing.
So, I mean, looking at his time in general, I could have done with a whole lot less of the maudlin Doctor. His sudden reluctance to take Martha on as a companion. That's the one thing that deviated to me from, you know, he is the classic Doctor here. I believe him to be the 10th, but then when we get to that, it's like, wait, but that's not the Doctor. He's got to be used to that after 900 years. And I just really don't believe Rose was that special to him. I didn't get that. He was that special to Rose, but I just don't get that this is the, you know, the new love of his life. And so I kind of, the stages of breakup and I don't want everything and drags down Martha's time in the TARDIS considerably, who would have been I thought was a fantastic companion, except for that whole bit. And then, of course, they had to play that up so that she's trying to be romantic with the Doctor and he's resisting it. So I didn't care for that. And I also didn't care for all the periods of time when they, between companions, like the movies, where they had to just kind of make a companion up for him because he refused to have a companion. It didn't feel that really worked. But that's not a reflection on Tennant or his portrayal. It's really it's a reflection on what he was given to work with.
I think that, I mean, what we see in this, he does work extremely well with Billy Piper, and there is, I mean, it's almost as if Rose's Doctor is now seen as Tennant in the way that Elizabeth Sladen's Doctor is seen as being Baker, even though she mm-hmm. was introduced as a companion to Pertwee. And so I think there's something, there's obviously, that's very fortunate in the sense that you've got a companion who was cast prior to the Doctor being cast, the new actor playing the Doctor, and yet this wonderful chemistry develops and they play really well off one another. And you've already got that in The Christmas Invasion. So, and I think in some ways, Rose is still seen as being the Tenth Doctor's main companion. I agree that I didn't think the dynamic with Martha worked so well. I thought that the dynamic with Donna was fantastic because you got something that where you do have this no second chances Doctor, where you have him starting to grow too big for his boots and to become somewhat arrogant, I suppose, somewhat of a know-it-all, then you need someone to take him down a peg. And that I think is what you get here with Jackie to some extent, but it's much more effective when you've actually got Donna travelling with him in the TARDIS.
That's the other thing that I don't necessarily agree. I mean, yes, the Doctor was taken down because he was too big for his pants at the end. That's beyond explicit. I mean, it's not something that you derive subtly from the story. It's basically spelled out for you in no uncertain terms. But as you say, it's here from the moment he starts. So I never saw that as an arc of him developing that way. It was an aspect of his personality from the way through. And I never saw them building that, as his ultimate downfall. And so when it came to being his ultimate downfall, I didn't think that was a fantastic arc payoff. I just felt that was, you know, if it had turned out this Doctor had been left-handed and he'd been left-handed throughout the entire series, and then they got down and he was on some planet where left-handed people got killed, it was kind of the same. It would have been like, oh yeah, okay, well, they just used something that's been there, and it wasn't a brilliant plan from the word go. It was, they just stumbled across it, and I probably because they don't build it. I don't really see them building this that character trait as we go along. So anyway, but I did want to mention the no second chances Doctor.
In school reunion, the
but that's scene so
by the
early.
Poolside, it is early, but it is building a bit. I didn't enjoy it. I mean, some of the following episodes, I mean, New Earth wasn't as good as The Christmas. I love the scene at the beginning where you see him patting the console and just looking up at the time rotor and you think, yeah, that's the Doctor. But overall, some of those episodes weren't quite as good. And part of that was because the slightly shouty Doctor didn't feel as well balanced as you got. He was quite restrained in The Christmas Invasion, and I thought that worked. That gave him a lot more strength when he was actually laying down the law, as it were.
Hmm. But the you know, in Christmas Invasion itself specifically, you have that scene where he's boisterous. He's brash. He's a know-it-all. He rashly takes on the Sycorax in a battle, which, you know, in retrospect, worked out for him. But until he got his hand cut off, that wasn't working out for him. And we have the... And I didn't get this the first time I watched it, to be fair. When they cut off the hand and his hand grows back and he says, and this new hand is a fighting hand, I thought that was bluster.
It is.
But his fighting gets a lot better afterwards. So actually, I'm not sure that it is. Did he improve his skills by growing that hand back? Or is it just he should have done that earlier and
well,
he didn't?
I don't know. It's an interesting question of whether the skills that he has actually regenerate when he regenerates. So, for example, can he still play cricket as well as the Fifth Doctor can play cricket, or at least as well as someone who, for whom it's been a long time since he played cricket, could be expected to mm-hmm. play, or do some of his skills disappear? I mean, the Fourth Doctor, it's the Ribos operation,
mm-hmm.
fencing in that. So, you know,
Third Doctor fencing, yeah, as well.
So
the Master.
Can he still ride a motorbike like Pertwee can and like McGann can? Do all those skills carry over? Because I just kind of assumed they did, really. Maybe they don't.
In a way, but I mean, let's face it, sometimes things Matt Smith does implies that the ability to walk didn't carry over. So, you know.
Well,
you know what I mean? I mean,
obviously, he's got to get used to his legs.
Yeah. Well, he's had 3 years, or four. It's been, but I, you know, he plays this thing all nice and happy-go-lucky and battly thing, and there is just that one moment of steel when he pulls that Satsuma out, or tangerine for our American listeners. And
are you saying that Satsumas and tangerines are the same? Sorry to interrupt, but I've just got to get this sorted out.
I believe so.
They're not different fruit.
They're not different fruits, to my knowledge.
So
we don't have Satsumas here at all. There's nothing ever labeled as Satsuma here.
What? This is obviously quite important. What do you call clementines?
A girl. Clementine's a girl's name.
Okay, I'm glad we got that cleared up. Do carry on.
A fascinating study on fruit here. The point being is that the Doctor turns to steel for a moment when he kills the Sycorax leader. I mean, he is happy, jokey, you know, I've done it, yay, victory, and then no second chances, and that guy is dead. Not even a blink.
Yeah.
And then he's back to, you know, there's a little moment where he kind of comes out of that mood. That was a phenomenal scene in
yes.
this episode. That was like, ooh, okay. And a doctor with a spine, too. Not just a goof,
yeah.
if you will.
You couldn't imagine the Fifth Doctor. I mean, he might have had the aim to do it.
No.
Going back to the skills.
No,
the
Fifth Doctor couldn't do
but
it.
But he wouldn't have had the spine to do it.
And I don't think Pertwee would have done it. Not like that.
Probably
I mean,
not.
I think he had the spine to do it, but I...
He wouldn't have done
it like
that.
He wouldn't have done it like that. No.
But the Fourth Doctor would.
Yes. I think the Fourth Doctor could have done that with his scarf, probably. Have you got anything else on this particular
special? I mean, another thing we've talked about is what's going on behind the scenes with production changes. Well, this is one where there aren't really any production changes because it's the same show. It's still a very relatively new show. I mean, it's had one series since Russell mm-hmm. T. Davies brought it back. So in that sense, it's just as old as John Nathan Turner's producership was. When Tom Baker left and he had to introduce Peter Davison. But for Davies, of course, Eccleston was his own doctor. He wasn't picking up a doctor from someone else and having him go. That was his only doctor. So in many ways, the continuity here is it is one of the most continuous changes from a lead doctor to another, I think.
I mean, there's no change in style or form or anything in the show. There's no major change in the tone of the stories or anything like that. One thing that I hate to do this, but I'll give kudos to John Nathan Turner, and I'm sure we talked about this a little bit. But when John Nathan Turner became producer and sat down with Tom Baker, he knew from the word go that Tom Baker was done. And you can kind of see that. That one, I agree, you can see building throughout Tom Baker's final year.
Yeah.
That they are lining him up for a regeneration. And we didn't get that through Eccleston, even though they must have known pretty early.
Well, they could. They couldn't do that through Eccleston because they had to actually introduce him and build him up. So there wasn't the scope for kind of having that as a team underlying the season. They needed to do everything in that season.
Yeah, that I wish I knew where in the production order they knew that he had quit. I know that they knew he had quit before the first episode aired, but
we know he got on better with some directors than others. I think he particularly liked Joe Ahern, who he mentioned in the statement that he gave on the 50th anniversary special. So obviously there were other directors who he didn't get on with,
or producers.
But I don't think they could have brought that into what we were seeing on screen, because it was so important that the viewers took the show in. And there was so much else going on as well, because the season varies enormously tonally, I think, because, and I think this is a deliberate thing, because they're trying things out with it. And so one episode will be very childish, I suppose. What you
fart jokish.
Yeah, the kind of sophomore humour. Whereas other episodes will be much more adult or much more action oriented, or you know, the full range is there, as well as kind of setting up the template for the show with let's do a historical and let's follow it up with a future episode and so on. Let's have a recurring monster. All those things are being tried out for the first time in that. I don't think you could add into the mix the kind of sense of doom and foreboding which accompanies the kind of demise of a doctor these days. Apart from the fact that I really don't like that doom and foreboding. It worked for the Tom Baker season, I thought. Since then, we'll come on to it, I'm sure. But
it doesn't have to be doom and foreboding, though. I mean...
Self-pity is actually the problem. That's the thing I object to in the dying days of the Tennant era, and which kind of feel like they're more present than I would like in what's turning out to be the end of Smith.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to come back and look at Matt Smith's regeneration start story, the 11th Hour, very soon now, if we want to get this done before Matt Smith is no more. So I guess that'll be soon. Well, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
And we hope our listeners will join us again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.